Welcome to session 4. 2 years ago, I had another student who was very smart and said that he wanted to go to a very selective college. When I asked him about his quarter grades, however, he explained that he was getting a C in English. Now, in and of itself, I don't really care what grades my students are getting if they are truly trying, but I knew that he was much more capable of getting a better grade and that C would not help him in achieving his goal of getting into a top choice school. So when I asked him why he was getting a C in class, he started complaining about how his English teacher hated him and how this woman was a bitch and how he didn't like the class. And I explained to him that none of that mattered, because as we all know as adults, the only way to change a situation is by taking responsibility for it and by not playing a victim, even if the teacher didn't like him and would not help him in any way. Instead, I advised him to do the exact opposite. I told him that I wanted him to start meeting with his English teacher. Now, after 15 seconds of him laughing at me, I said, "No, I'm serious. I want you to go and talk to her, and I have some specific things that I want you to say to her." Well, this boy didn't want to do it, but I asked him, "Look, have I ever led you wrong in the 8 months that we've known each other?" He said, "No." So I said, "Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal first. I'll script out for you what it is that I want you to say to your teacher. Then if she's willing to do so, I would like you to simply meet with your teacher 2 times. If you do what I suggest, and at the end of those 2 meetings, you have not found any value, I will completely leave you alone and admit that I was wrong." But I've never been wrong about this. He sighed heavily and said, "All right, what do you want me to do?" I explained to him that I wanted him to go up to the teacher when he could talk with her one-on-one. And I wanted him to say something like this: "Hey, Mrs. Whatever her name was. I just want to let you know that I've been thinking about it, and this class really is important to me. So I'm going to start putting forth more of an effort, and I'm going to start trying harder in your class. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm taking this seriously." That's it. Don't ask for anything else. Just say those words or something like it. And then I told him that he needed to start actually trying in class. And by trying, I mean paying attention, trying to answer questions, engaging and not being on his phone or talking to his friends. I recommended that he make a real effort because the teacher is going to start watching him to see if he is serious about his declaration, and so he would need to prove himself. And then I told him after a few days, I wanted him to go back up to his teacher and say something like this: "I really want to improve my writing, and I was wondering if I could come and meet with you whenever it's convenient to brainstorm my next paper so that I can sort of learn how to structure my ideas and write a better paper." Well, fortunately, the student actually did these 2 things, and the teacher agreed to meet with him. After the 2 meetings, the boy came back to me and was amazed. He said, "Danny, you're not going to believe what happened today." I said, "Tell me." He said, "You know, the first time I went with my teacher, she didn't really help me at all. And I thought, this is a waste of time. But you know, you told me to do it twice. So on the second time, she literally helped me outline the entire paper and gave me the ideas she thought would be important. Basically, she saved me like 4 hours worth of work." And I said, "Yeah, I know that. That's why I told you what I told you, because I used to be a school teacher, and teachers, even if they aren't good ones, still want to believe that they're impacting their students in a positive way. So if you're sincere and you demonstrate that you're sincere, you'd be amazed at the amount of help the teachers can give you and the amount of time that a teacher can save you." And lo and behold, he would end up getting an A on that paper. In fact, this really works with any subject. Now, having said this, English and history teachers are generally more helpful than math and science just because of how subjective the subjects are. But I've seen this strategy work in every situation. So in this session, I want to cover a set of unique tools and strategies I have developed since I started as a school teacher when I was 22. Actually, they started before that when I was in college at Stanford. You see, at the time, I was still a huge procrastinator and really had no time management skills whatsoever. I could do school really well, but I was always stressing out my freshman year because I would inevitably be staying up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday doing an assignment that I'd put off until the last minute. And over time, the stress was starting to eat at me the same way it had my senior year in high school. Well, fortunately for me, I met a woman who was older than I was and who was an exceptional student. But not only was she brilliant, she was exceptional at how she approached school. She was the first one to show me a different way of how to study, how to be efficient and smart. She showed me how to approach my assignments and completely changed how I did school. Over the years, not only have I found that very, very few students have ever heard about these strategies, but I've also seen time and time again how they've worked for my students. However, there are 2 challenges. Number 1, your teen actually has to be willing to try something new. And 2, they have to continue to try doing the new skill until the new behavior takes hold. As I have mentioned several times, psychologists have proven that any new habit takes 3 weeks. And as you may know, teenagers can be really stubborn and believe that they know everything when that might not exactly be the case. So, like I mentioned in session 2, I suggest trying to make a deal with a teenager to get them to at least try a new strategy similar to what I did with the boy in my first example. Now, in the guide attached to this session, you'll see that I've actually written lists of study skills that I teach as if I were writing them to your teen. I did this so you can print them out and go over them with your child so that they can see someone other than you came up with these ideas and therefore might be more open to listening to you. Again, not every student will immediately do all of these, nor will every student find every approach useful. I will simply say that these are strategies that the very smartest students use all the way through college to get the maximum results with the least amount of stress. Or another way of saying it is that the best students really learn how to become efficient, so they work less and work smarter, so they have time to do other things they really enjoy. Now, usually when I phrase things in that way, in other words, so a teenager can get more of what they want, I can get them to try some of the strategies. So if you look at the guide, the first strategy I mentioned is the one that I helped the boy with, which is talk to teachers. Now, most parents will agree that this is absolutely a good idea, but many, many students are resistant, or they don't do it in the right way. The first step I teach students is to explain to their teacher that they want to do better in the class. Then they should discuss finding a time that works for the teacher. You see, a lot of students will just go up to the teacher at the end of class right before a test when everyone else is trying to ask the teacher a question and say, "Hey, can I meet with you to review stuff?" Well, that doesn't work because the teacher knows that a student is just trying to get answers for the test. And a teacher is often busy with things and can't meet a student at the last minute. Instead, they should plan ahead. They should find out when their teacher likes to meet, whether that's after lunch or after school or during a student's free period. Then the student should show up on time and come prepared with questions. Even if a student knows the answers to the questions, it's important that they at least appear interested and want to make an effort. The truth is that only by being genuine will a student allow the teacher to want to help. Okay, so the second strategy is about note-taking. Now, when I work with students, I actually show them a demonstration about how to take notes properly, and we go through it step by step. But I'm just going to give an overview for you. Now, you don't need to remember all of this, but I want to at least give you the concept so if you do show the printout to your son or daughter, you'll be able to understand what I'm talking about. You see, most kids simply take notes by writing down everything the teacher says. The problem with this approach is that not everything a teacher says is important, and students are so busy writing things down that they're not actually listening or absorbing any of the material. So in order to combat this, there's a way of taking notes that's based on what my 9th grade geometry teacher used to call key concepts. These key concepts are really about listening for 3 different things. So students should listen for a question, they should listen for the proof that answers the question, and then they should listen for the conclusion. So, for example, if a student was talking about the possible causes of World War I, the teacher may go through a variety of lists and stories to illustrate the causes to conclude that it wasn't one thing, but a series of events that was triggered by the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Now, what I'm laying out here is mostly for what I call fuzzy classes, or English and history classes that are based around key ideas. Although the same strategy also generally works for science classes, because teachers often create their lectures based on a series of questions, such as, what is photosynthesis? That's photosynthesis. Why do mitochondria behave the way that they do? Now, math is a little different, and taking math notes really means that a student should get down as many practice problems as possible so they can be practiced again later. But for a fuzzy class, a teacher is typically asking a big question or a series of questions throughout the lecture. Now, sometimes a teacher doesn't start with a question, but starts with a conclusion. Let's say that the teacher started with the statement, World War I was caused by a series of events stemming from the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand. Great, that's a conclusion. Now, a student will write that down, or this statement down, at the end of the piece of paper, and then listen for the proof that leads to that conclusion and maybe some questions along the way. The questions could be something like, why was the assassination of the Archduke of Ferdinand important? The more a student can train themselves to listen this way, the easier it is to be able to remember the important points of any lecture. Additionally, this strategy of listening for a question, the proof, and the conclusion also corresponds to how I teach a student to read a textbook in half the time it normally takes, which we'll talk about next. So let's say, for example, that a teacher is lecturing. She's asked a question and gives evidence, but she never really gives the conclusion. Well, a student can recognize this fact and then raise her hand and ask what the conclusion is, or talk to the teacher after class to make sure she got the main point that the teacher was trying to make. You see, the bottom line is that by actively listening and only writing down select important points instead of the tangents that the teacher will often go on, the more a student will remember and the more that they will engage with the material and the more they will be able to recall it on a test. Now, there are also some ways that I recommend students should emphasize things in their notes. So, if, for example, a teacher says, such and such is, quote, an important concept for you to remember, or a teacher says something like, you might want to remember this on your, for your test. Well, students should underline or circle that part in the notes so that when a student reviews, it will be easier to spot that important point that the teacher emphasized. The other key aspect of taking notes is to listen when a teacher uses the words but or however, because they signal an exception to the point the teacher was making and can often be a counterexample that shows up in the form of a multiple choice question, such as, all the following took place except this. Does that make sense? So you would be amazed that if you, as a parent, went into a lecture, wrote down on a piece of paper the words question, proofs, proof, conclusion, and then listened for those three elements, and then saw how those notes actually showed up on a test, you'd be amazed at how much better you would remember the information from a class because you were actively listening instead of just scribbling down words. Now, there are some research that shows that writing things down by hand on a piece of paper results in greater retention. And actually, I believe this to be true. However, these days, students can often type faster than they can write, and it's easier for them to keep the notes organized. So if a student prefers to take notes on a computer, and if their school allows it, I actually encourage it. Additionally, I use a free program called Microsoft OneNote. And I show this to all my students. Not only can students keep notes organized, but it's brilliant because you can put your cursor anywhere on the page and take notes, which allows students to write down related ideas or go back and add reading notes next to the lecture notes. Students can even draw on the pages if they have a touchscreen. Now, when a student reads a textbook, they can apply the same concept of looking for questions, proof, and the conclusion. In fact, looking for these three elements in each section of a history or science textbook, students can again increase their retention and get through the material much faster. Now, when I was in school, I used to try to use a highlighter to note the important things that I needed to remember. But research has shown that the highlighter isn't actually effective. Just because students are highlighting something they read, it doesn't mean that their brain is really keying into why that part is important in the context of the entire passage. They're just marking it to go back later, and almost no one ever goes back later to read their highlights. So instead, I tell students to first look for the big question the author is trying to answer in any section. Now, a lot of times, the question is either in the header itself or will be in the first paragraph someplace. The next thing that a student wants to do is look for the answer to the question. Now, this usually comes in the form of a thesis statement, which is a summary of why or what took place that answers the first question. Now, unlike a paper, a thesis in a textbook doesn't always come at the end. Although, I should say it doesn't always come in the beginning, it often comes at the end. So students can often look at the last part of the section to see what the author writes as a conclusion, and that'll probably be the answer to the question. So now that students have noted where the question and the answer is, or the thesis is, or the conclusion is, they now write them down on their notes, leaving a space in between. Now, the next thing to do is that they skim the rest of the text in between without writing anything down. So along the way, students should put a check mark next to the sentences or paragraphs that seem important or that make a new point. I know this sounds confusing, but hang in there with me. Okay, then they go back to where they made the first little mark and they write a brief little summary about what is next to the mark. Now, again, I can hear teenagers out there. When I have mentioned this to my students, they're like, there's no way I'm going to do that. It takes so long and I don't want to make notes anyway. I can just remember what I read. Well, the truth is that some students can remember what they read, and if this is the case and their classes are easy, they can ignore this strategy. However, once a student gets good at actively reading, they'll find that it actually takes less time. They get less tired and they remember more information. Yes, it takes a bit of time to get used to, and it obviously doesn't apply to math textbooks or pieces of literature. But like with note-taking, it's kind of exciting to realize that many of the exact things that students write down are suddenly showing up on the test. And this, of course, means that by taking notes and reading using the system, studying for tests becomes easier and faster. In other words, most students read, don't remember anything, have to re-skim it or read it again. Then they study for a test in which they also don't remember anything, and they're trying to learn it all from scratch. See, they're trying to put too much information in their heads the night before the test, which means they can't possibly remember it all, which means they underperform on the test. All I tell students to do is to give this a try for a week or for one unit and just see what happens. The bottom line is that when a student gets the hang of this, each question from a piece of reading should simply have between 4 and 10 pieces of summarized proof, plus the question in the beginning and the conclusion at the end. That means that a typical article or a chapter really shouldn't take more than a page of notes, and honestly, shouldn't take more than a half an hour or hour to do. Now, obviously, some students take longer than others to read, but when they get really efficient at being able to spot the question, then the conclusion, and then the supporting facts, they feel accomplished, especially when they start doing better than they ever did before. All right, let me stop for a second and say that you're all doing great. I know that if you're listening to this for the first time, I could have lost you 7 or 8 minutes ago. I know this isn't the sexiest of topics. So thank you for hanging in there with me, because I've got one more part to talk about just so that you understand my philosophy and how the three parts work together. Let's talk about mastering the art of test prep. First, I want to propose something radical. I suggest students start off the first 2 weeks of school by giving 120% in the class. Why? Because in the first 2 or 3 weeks, teachers automatically start putting students into categories and judging them. Is this a serious student? Is this a student I like? Is this kid a slacker? Has this kid pissed me off? And once those judgments have been made, they're harder to undo. So a lot of boys think, oh, I'll just sort of like not worry about the first 3 weeks because it's easy, and then I'll kick it in once everything's warmed up. But the smart student would do the opposite. A smart student would think, I'm going to do really good in the beginning to get the teacher to know that I'm really trying. Then I can dial it back to a normal level after 2 or 3 weeks. So if I ever have a problem and I can't finish an assignment on time or I don't feel well, there's a much higher likelihood that the teacher is going to do me a favor since I've already proven myself. The brilliant thing about this strategy is that once a student has established a relationship with the teacher, they can then ask the teacher a valuable question when they meet one-on-one. They can ask, hey, if you were me, what would you focus on studying for the upcoming test? Now, if a student asked this to a teacher the day before an exam and had not established a pattern of going in and asking good questions, there's no way that a teacher is going to help. But if a student has already established themselves in the beginning of the year and then met regularly over the course of the year, a teacher is much more likely to give amazing insight about what's going to show up on the test. Now, not every teacher might do this. And the teacher is not going to give away the students the exact answers, but a teacher can save a student substantial amounts of time and really point them in the right direction of how to study that can save them hours. Even if a student has messed around in the beginning of a class, like my first student example, they can still turn it around first by telling and then demonstrating to a teacher that they're taking things seriously. Now, next up, I suggest students print out or dig up both the lecture notes and the reading notes for a given unit. So let's say that a test is on 3 chapters of history books. Well, I like to gather both sets of notes for each chapter and then staple or paperclip them together and label the top page with how they're connected. So for example, a staple pile may have the lecture notes and the reading notes for chapter 37. And then we'll have another packet that has all the notes for chapter 38. Now, because a student has followed the three-part process of asking questions, looking for proof, and writing down conclusions, they pretty much already have made a study guide for themselves. But again, there's a difference between passive learning and active learning. Passive learning is simply trying to read something and memorize it. Active learning is when a student makes their brain recall the information. So when I was a tutor, I would basically say to a student, here's a question and an answer, look at it. Okay, now I'm going to take everything away from you and I want you to write out all the things that you can remember about how to answer the question. You see, the more a student tries to recall information without any help or without any aids, the more that they will be able to remember it on test day. In fact, all a student has to do is write down one of the questions from class and then fill in as many pieces of evidence as they can remember, followed by the conclusion. This way, if they then see a similar question, whether it be a multiple choice or a short answer, they're going to more easily recall the answer. Again, when I tell students this strategy, they look at me as if I've told them to move heavy rocks for 12 hours. But yet, even though it might sound terrible, when they start doing it and they realize they're not falling asleep and are actually remembering things, they find it's a pretty easy habit to pick up. Now, for vocabulary or something like biology facts or historical dates, I like to use good old-fashioned note cards. The app Quizlet online works well too, but I like physical note cards because students can give them to someone else to test them. A student can also write down a question on one side of a note card and the answer on the back to try to make themselves recall it. If they get the answer right, the note card goes in the know it pile. If the student gets the answer wrong, it goes in the doesn't know it pile, and a student should keep reviewing that pile until they get every single one right. See, by doing this, students are transferring information from their short-term memory to their long-term memory, so it stays in there for the upcoming test. Now, the key with math and some science like chemistry is to simply try problems. But it's not just enough to look at their homework and say, oh yeah, I know that one. No, students should write down a lot of math problems on a blank piece of paper and then actually try doing them until they can do each question from beginning to end. Once a student can look at any question in the book or in their notes and actually be able to write out the answer, then they're ready for the test. Now, to a lot of you listening, this would all seem to make rational sense, right? However, it's very rare that I see a school teach these kinds of habits or even teach any study skills whatsoever. So the trick is whether your teenager will listen to you. Again, I made this program so that you have summary sheets to give to your teen. I suggest you also explain it to them and even follow up with them. Now, they may not seem like they're listening, but they are hearing you. And maybe you only take one thing at a time, or maybe you try to teach one simple concept as an example. I don't know what will work best for you and your teen. I do know, however, that I use these strategies on a regular basis and have taught them hundreds, if not thousands of times. So I know that they work, and hopefully they'll work for your son or daughter. Now, once a student gets back the test, most kids just shove it in their backpack and never look at it again. That is, if a teacher's even good enough to give back the test. But the smart student actually looks at the answers they got wrong and asks, why? Why did I get this question wrong? And where did the information come from so that I can improve on studying for the next test? Okay, the final suggestion I want to make is so simple, but so effective. I suggest that students write down every assignment, every day, that it's given in class. Now, a lot of my students will say, well, why would I want to do that? Like, my teacher gives assignments online, or I can just remember it. Now, many teachers don't realize how missing one assignment and getting a zero can impact their grade. So even if a student can remember things, quote, most of the time, it only takes a couple of mistakes to drag a grade down. So I recommend that a student get a notebook or even type each assignment in their phone or on their computer. The key is that they must make a rule that they cannot leave class without writing down exactly what they have to do that night, even if they have to ask the teacher again. See, not only will this help students remember what they have to do and avoid getting a zero on the homework because they forgot to turn in something, but it also lets them learn how to prioritize and do their work more efficiently, which is a huge skill to have when midterms and finals come around. I'll give you an example. I had a student a couple years ago who would typically have A's, or I would say A's and A minuses going into his finals. But then he would bomb his finals and end up with B's and B pluses, which was really frustrating because he worked hard all semester to do really well, only to have one test lower his grade. Sound familiar to anyone? So what I did leading up to his finals his junior year is that I sat him down and said, okay, let's make a list of all the classes that you have finals in. Let's take the first one, say English. What is everything that you can list, that you can think of, that you have to do to study for the final? And I had him write it down. Then I had him make a time estimate about how long each step in the list would take him to complete. Now, I told him how important it was to be conservative here. So if he thought that looking over his English notes would take 2 hours, I had him write down that it would take 3 hours because no student studies in one gigantic block. Now, they take breaks, they get distracted, and usually it takes longer than expected. So we did this for every class so that every subject had a series of actions and a series of time estimates. Now, we wanted to plan out the week leading up to finals, and what we did is time blocked, but we were really realistic. Most students will say that they're going to study for 3, 4, 7 hours straight. Well, they may sit there for 4 hours, but they're not going to absorb probably more than 3/4 of an hour to an hour of the material. It's a complete waste of time. Instead, a student has to understand whether they best study in 20-minute blocks, 40-minute blocks, or an hour block before they have to take a break. And not like a break like watch all the seasons of Game of Thrones. Instead, students should plan like a 20-minute snack or a 30-minute television show break. The key is that students have to be really honest with themselves and then stay realistic. If a student doesn't work well in the morning, they shouldn't schedule study time in the morning. It has to work on their schedule. In other words, the student has to buy into their own plan and feel like it's possible. So I told the boy that the truth is that the plan that we laid out wasn't probably going to end up working out exactly the way that we thought. But the fact that we made a plan and that we blocked out enough time over the course of the week to cover everything that he wrote down gave him a sense of security, and it gave him a sense of confidence that he could actually pull it off. And lo and behold, that semester was the first semester in his life that he got A's on most of his finals. And he told me that while his actual studying didn't end up looking exactly like the plan that we made, he could easily adjust the time blocks and move things around. And because he was realistic with himself, he was actually able to study during the time blocks and not feel like giving up when his plan went south. So this type of prioritizing works on a daily basis too. I have students write down every assignment after class so that the list is already there. Then, at home, I have them assign time frames to each assignment, estimating how long each one's going to take. Then, I have them prioritize the work as to what is actually the most important thing to do on a given day. This means that just because a student doesn't like history doesn't mean that they should put it off until the very last thing they do every day. If a student has a big math test the next day, but they don't have a history test for a week and a half, well, then they probably want to prioritize math first and get it out of the way. Now again, for most adults, all this probably seems logical. But to a teenager, it often doesn't occur to them unless they're a high-achieving student who is just really naturally organized and good at this. But that's rare. So once a student has written down the priorities, the timeline, and knows how much work to do, then they can look at the time that they have that day or that night and say, okay, if I have 3 hours of work to do, when am I going to do it? Does it make sense to put it all off until 11 o'clock that night? No. But I hear you out there. What if my child has sports or theater or some extracurricular? Well, I would ask them what time could they start their work once they get home? You know, first they have to eat dinner and then they may have to take a shower. So what time are we really starting? And is that enough, or should we look at when they might have an hour block during a free period that they could start the work during school? Aha! See, now we're getting smart.